imagine a giant synchronized symphony orchestra.
Okay.
You have hundreds of musicians on stage, and every single one of them plays a highly specialized instrument, right? They all have their distinct sheet music, distinct timing, their very specific role in making the music happen.
Right, of course.
Now, imagine the tuba player suddenly gets sick right before the performance.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you can't just hand that massive brass tuba over to, like, a violinist and expect the same song to come out.
No, definitely not.
The whole rhythm falls apart, and that fragility, that total reliance on specialized human roles is exactly what we're getting into today. Welcome to today's deep dive.
Glad to be here.
So our mission today is to unpack a really fascinating operational guide from Industrial Staffing Experts, RSS Inc., which stands for Regional Supplemental Services. They tackle this exact problem, how massive global supply chains survive when the tuba player calls in sick.
Yeah, it's a great analogy, actually.
Because, you know, whether you're a business owner waiting on crucial inventory or you're just sitting there waiting for your morning coffee beans or, I don't know, that new phone to arrive, you are entirely dependent on these massive port systems not breaking down.
You really are.
Mm-hmm.
And the RSS guide is just a fascinating document to dive into because it forces us to look past the physical infrastructure.
Right.
Like when we visualize global trade, we usually picture steel.
Yeah.
Right? We see massive cargo ships, those towering ship-to-shore cranes, anchors of brightly colored shipping containers.
Yeah, it looks indestructible.
Exactly. We think of indestructible machines. But this operational guide zeroes in on the human element, revealing the ports are actually, they're incredibly fragile environment.
Fragile. Really?
Very. A single, seemingly isolated disruption like, say, a localized health crisis that keeps one shift at home, or a sudden severe weather event, or a labor dispute, or honestly, even just an unexpected surge in cargo volume, it can all cascade into massive congestion.
Okay, I have to jump in here, actually. I'm stuck right out of the gate. Let me push back on this premise a little bit.
Go for it.
Because when I see footage of a modern port, I see what looks like a highly automated, robot-driven environment, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
We have digital tracking systems, automated guided vehicles, software managing the logistics of thousands of containers. If we have $50 million automated cranes, why can't the manufacturer just remote operate them from a desk in another state?
Right. That's
like, why is physical human presence still the ultimate bottleneck? With all our modern technology, why does a human labor shortage cause such an immediate crisis? Why can't we just put the whole port on autopilot?
So that is the trap a lot of observers fall into. We assume automation means autonomy.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And the source addresses this head on by introducing a concept called critical path dependency.
Critical path dependency.
Right. The reality on the ground is just much less forgiving. The equipment, the infrastructure, and all those incredibly sophisticated digital systems, they are completely useless without highly skilled human operators.
Yeah.
You need them to manage the exceptions, the maintenance, and all the physical variables that software simply cannot predict.
So the technology doesn't replace the labor. The technology requires the labor to function at all.
Exactly. Think about a ship-to-shore crane.
Right.
Right? You're moving a container that weighs tens of thousands of pounds.
Yeah, huge.
Right, swinging on cables and unpredictable coastal winds, and you're trying to slot it into a space on a truck chassis with maybe an inch of clearance.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, an algorithm can calculate the trajectory, sure, but it takes a certified, experienced human operator to make those micro adjustments in real time.
I didn't think about the wind and all that.
Exactly. You cannot simply substitute an untrained person or an AI to manage that. Furthermore, you need experienced drivers to coordinate terminal tractors and yard equipment. You need trained administrative staff to handle complex gate processing, customs compliance.
Right, the paperwork alone.
Oh, it's massive. And specialized maintenance teams to ensure the machinery doesn't break down mid-lift. If the crane operator doesn't show up, that multi-million dollar piece of equipment is just a giant metal sculpture.
Just sitting there. Which means you need backups.
Yes.
But, I mean, if you're managing a team right now, you know how incredibly hard it is to cover for just one person who goes on vacation?
Right. It's a nightmare.
Now scale that up to a massive terminal. How do port authorities actually organize thousands of backup workers without going completely bankrupt? Having a shadow workforce of crane operators just, you know, sitting in a break room waiting for a disaster sounds financially impossible.
Oh, it would absolutely bankrupt a terminal if they just hired a mob of extra people to stand around. The answer, according to the RSS guide, isn't bloated overstaffing. It's a highly structured architecture. They call the tiered contingency workforce model.
Tiered contingency. Got it.
Yeah. Redundancy in this context is a controlled overlap in capability. Its purpose is to preserve operational integrity. It ensures that when primary labor resources become unavailable, pre-qualified alternatives can step in without degrading safety or productivity.
This sounds a bit like a professional sports franchise.
Oh, how so?
Like, you have your depth chart, you don't just have your starting lineup and then a bunch of random people on the stands waiting to play.
Right, exactly.
You have a very specific strategic hierarchy of who gets called off the bench depending on the injury.
The sports depth chart is a great way to visualize it, actually.
All right.
The source breaks this architecture down into four distinct layers.
Okay, four layers.
Yeah, and this allows for controlled escalation rather than, you know, reactive panic. The first layer is the core workforce.
The starters.
Exactly, your starters. These are your full-time, highly skilled personnel. They require very low supervision. They possess deep familiarity with the terminal-specific operating systems, and they maintain the baseline productivity.
Okay, so what happens when, say, a localized health outbreak hits and suddenly 15% of your starters can't come to work?
That triggers the second layer, the extended workforce.
Okay.
This consists of cross-trained internal employees, maybe part-time staff, and redeployable personnel from other departments. They provide immediate reinforcement because they already have moderate training across multiple roles within the company.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, and because they're already in the system, they can shift functions rapidly with very minimal onboarding.
Wait, hold on. If Tier 2 is just internal staff from other departments, how do you prevent an HR nightmare where, like, an accountant accidentally gets behind the wheel of a 50-ton terminal tractor?
Oh, yeah, no.
There has to be a mechanism to stop people from doing jobs that might get someone killed, right?
Oh, absolutely. The guide is very strict about this.
Huh.
You do not just throw an office worker into heavy machinery.
Okay, good.
The strategy relies on cross-training for adjacent roles.
Adjacent roles.
Right. So you cross-train a crane operator to also run yard equipment. Or you train gate personnel in documentation and compliance processes. The skills have to overlap logically.
That makes total sense.
And crucially, this cross-training must be formally certified. The RSS text warns heavily against informal skill sharing.
Like the buddy system.
Yeah, the whole, hey, let me show you how to pull these levers real quick approach.
Yeah.
That introduces massive safety risks and operational inconsistency.
Right. Okay, so you have your starters and you have your cross-trained internal backups. But what if the disruption is catastrophic?
Okay.
What if a severe hurricane takes out power to half the city and 40% of your entire workforce is dealing with flooded homes? The internal backups won't be enough then.
No, they won't. And that is when management hits stage three, the contingent workforce.
Okay, tier three.
Yes. This is pure surge capacity. These are external labor sources. Think staffing agencies, specialized contractors, temporary workers.
Right.
The defining characteristic of this tier is that they are pre-vetted. They aren't continuously active at the port, which saves money, but they have already passed the background checks and safety certification.
Oh, so they're ready to go?
Mostly, yeah. They do require structured onboarding and more supervision when they arrive.
Yeah.
But they give the port massive scalability based on demand.
And what if things go from bad to apocalyptic?
Then you reach the fourth and final tier, the emergency workforce.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. These are non-traditional labor pools, sometimes even government-supported options like the National Guard in extreme national crises.
Oh, the National Guard.
Yeah, it's a last resort. They have very limited specialization, require extremely high supervision, and their only focus is maintaining the absolute bare minimum of operational continuity. You aren't trying to break efficiency records with Tier 4. You are just trying to keep the supply chain from flatlining.
Man, looking at the risk matrix included in the guide, which is fascinating, by the way, the math completely shattered my assumptions about how disasters work.
How so?
Well, I assumed the sheer size of a storm or a strike dictated the financial damage to a port. But the data proves something entirely different.
Yes, the matrix illustrates a really fascinating reality about risk management. Mm-hmm. It shows that the severity of the crisis isn't actually what dictates the outcome.
And it's just wild.
Right. Imagine a minor 3-hour power outage. That is technically a moderate disruption. But if a port has low preparedness, no backup generators, no communication plan for the truck drivers, no tier 2 workforce ready to manually process gate tickets.
Chaos.
Complete chaos. That 3-hour outage causes trucks to back up onto the interstate for miles. Perishable goods in refrigerated containers spoil. Ships miss their tidal windows to leave the harbor. It costs millions of dollars. The result is a major operational failure.
From a 3-hour outage. The inverse is also true, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Now imagine a massive Category 4 hurricane hits. A severe disruption. But because the port has high preparedness, they activated their contingency tiers 48 hours in advance. They secured the cranes, routed the contingent workforce to secure staging areas, and systematically powered down.
Wow.
After the storm passes, they resume operations seamlessly. The port survives. Preparedness, not the weather, dictates the outcome.
It makes you realize that having a plan isn't a luxury. It's the very thing that dictates survival. But let's look at the elephant in the room here.
Okay.
We're talking about ports, which are heavily unionized, complex political environments. Let's say a massive disruption hits, half the core workforce is out, and a port manager is bleeding millions of dollars a day trying to keep cargo moving.
Right.
If that manager gets desperate, ignores the union rules, and just brings in a bunch of external contingent workers to save the day, couldn't that actually trigger a worse crisis?
It absolutely would.
Yeah.
The RSS guide is unequivocal about the danger of ignoring labor dynamics. Labor agreements and union contracts directly shape the feasibility of any contingency strategy.
You can't just bypass them.
No, not at all. These agreements define permissible staffing models, strict role assignments, and very specific deployment conditions.
So you can't just play fast and loose with the contracts because there's a storm. A manager can't just point to the flooded roads and say, you know, we had to do what we had to do.
No, the labor contracts don't disappear just because the weather is bad. There are strict restrictions on subcontracting, defined job classifications that heavily limit cross-functional work, strict seniority rules for who gets offered overtime first.
Oh, of course.
And mandatory staffing ratios. If a manager bypasses those agreements to bring in unapproved external labor, the union will file grievances, set up picket lines, and initiate solidarity walkouts.
Wow.
Yeah, you could very easily turn a 3-day weather delay into a 3-week labor strike that paralyzes the entire region.
Which means the contingency planning must involve proactive engagement with labor representatives long before the crisis actually happens. You have to agree on the rules of the emergency game while the skies are still clear and everyone is calm.
That is the core of effective risk management.
Mm-hmm.
And it is where evaluating internal versus external labor sourcing becomes a very delicate balancing act.
How so?
Well, internal sourcing, redeploying your own cross-trained staff, gives you high skill familiarity and immediate deployment.
Mm-hmm.
More importantly, it is usually very compliant with existing labor agreements because they are already union members.
Right, that makes sense.
But its scalability is fundamentally limited. You only have so many internal employees.
True.
External sourcing gives you massive scalability to handle a massive crisis, but it brings variable skill levels, requires more rapid training, and carries much higher compliance risks with those labor agreements.
So knowing all these rules, having the 4-tier depth chart built, understanding the union dynamics, it all leads to the ultimate moment of truth.
The crisis.
The crisis hits, the tuba player is out. How does management actually know when to pull the trigger and activate the plan? Because if you bring in hundreds of expensive external workers too early, you waste a fortune. But if you wait too long, the port is already backed up, the trucks are on the highway, and you're failing.
Yeah, you cannot base a multi-million dollar deployment on a manager's gut feeling. The guide outlines a formal decision framework to prevent premature escalation or delayed response.
Okay, a framework.
Yes, it relies on predefined trigger thresholds. These are measurable, data-driven tripwires.
What does a tripwire look like in a port?
It could be a specific metric. For example, if workforce availability for a specific shift drops below 85%, or if the vessel backlog waiting at anchorage exceeds a hard capacity limit of 5 ships.
Oh, wait.
Or if terminal yard utilization reaches 80%, meaning there's physically no more room to stack containers. Once a specific threshold is crossed, it triggers a staged escalation governed by operations leadership.
So it's very systematic.
Completely. You don't jump straight to tier 3. You move from stage 1, reallocating internal resources, to stage 2, activating the extended workforce, and so on, based on the data.
And this is where the strategic partner comes in. The guide is written by RSS Inc., and they detail their specific role in this ecosystem.
Yes.
When I was reading this, I realized RSS isn't just a gig economy app where a port manager frantically taps a button for 50 random laborers to show up.
Definitely not.
It's much more sophisticated than that. It is honestly more like a private fire department. But they aren't just showing up with hoses when the alarm rings. They have already checked your fire hydrants, memorized your floor plan, and signed waivers with the union reps months before the fire ever starts.
That is a great analogy.
By the time the crisis hits, they aren't external help anymore. They are integrated.
That is the perfect way to visualize their value proposition. The text emphasizes that RSS provides pre-qualified industrial talent pools.
Pre-qualified.
Right. These aren't general office temps looking for data entry work. These are workers vetted specifically for physically demanding, safety-sensitive, heavy industrial environments.
Which is so important in a port.
Exactly. Because RSS specializes in logistics, warehousing, and transportation-adjacent roles, they drastically reduce the onboarding friction.
They already speak the language of the port. They know what a chassis is. They know gate protocols. They know basic terminal safety.
Exactly. They offer faster time to productivity because they're familiar with industrial workflows.
Hmm.
The goal is for them to act as a practical, seamless extension of the internal workforce rather than a chaotic last-minute patch.
Okay, I want to circle back to technology, because we established earlier that algorithms can't drive the tractors or swing the cranes.
Right.
But how does technology orchestrate this massive influx of contingent labor? Like, if you suddenly have 200 RSS workers showing up at the gate, how do you process them without creating a massive bottleneck? Does a port manager get an automated dashboard alert? Or how does this actually function mechanically?
That's a great question. The integration of technology is what makes the deployment possible. The source notes that technology enables workforce flexibility by improving coordination and visibility. It works through deep integrations. A port's terminal operating system, or TOS, is monitoring those tripwires we discussed.
Right, the 85% availability and all that.
Exactly. When throughput drops and a threshold is triggered, the TOS can use API integrations to automatically communicate with a partner like RSS. Automated alerts go out, pinging the phones of those pre-vetted workers.
So the system is actively calling in the reserves based on real-time data.
Yes. And when those workers arrive, access control systems streamline their credentialing.
Oh, that's smart.
Yeah, they aren't standing in line filling out paper forms for 3 hours. Their digital credentials have already been verified. They scan in, the terminal operating system registers their presence, and the software immediately assigns them to a specific terminal tractor or gate assignment based on their pre-certified skill profile.
Wow.
The technology orchestrates the contingent workforce. It gets the right pre-vetted worker to the right machine at the exact right moment.
It is the conductor of the symphony, making sure the backup tuba player knows exactly which measure they're stepping into, and ensuring they have the sheet music in front of them the second they sit down.
Exactly. And the ultimate measure of all this, the effectiveness of the entire contingency plan, isn't about having a theoretical binder sitting on a shelf in the manager's office.
All right.
The RSS guide states that effectiveness must be measured through actual operational outcomes. It is measured by throughput stability during disruptions.
Did the boxes keep moving?
Exactly. It is measured by the time it takes to actually deploy the contingent labor from the moment the tripwire is crossed.
Yeah.
And most importantly, it is measured by keeping safety incident rates low, even when the terminal is flooded with temporary workers operating heavy machinery in a high-stress environment.
So what does this all mean for you listening right now? We've journeyed through an incredibly complex, high-stakes world today.
We really have.
We started by looking at the sheer fragility of port labor, shattering the myth that automated machines and software alone can save us when things go wrong. We explored the architecture of survival, the tiered contingency models that prevent financial ruin, the sports-like depth charts, and the strict non-negotiable rules around adjacent cross-training and proactive union agreements.
Right.
And finally, we looked at the execution. We saw how structured decision frameworks, API integrations, and strategic partners like RSS Inc. function as an integrated, pre-vetted safety net to keep the global supply chain moving.
And, you know, looking at this massive physical blueprint, leaves us with a profound realization about resilience.
Oh, definitely.
The most complex technology-heavy physical networks on Earth, these global supply chains that dictate the flow of the modern world, do not rely on the assumption that things will go perfectly. And they certainly don't assume that automation is a magic bullet that will save them from disruptions. They survive because they have meticulously planned human redundancy. They rely on cross-training adjacent skills, acknowledging the difficult political realities of their environment, and partnering with external talent long before the crisis ever hits.
Which brings up a really interesting question for you to ponder as we wrap up this deep dive. We just spent this time talking about heavy machinery and physical supply chains, but think about your own workplace for a second.
Yeah, it applies everywhere.
As we all rush to implement AI, large language models, and automated software into our own white-collar jobs, are we accidentally stripping away our tier two human redundancy?
That's a scary thought.
If we automate all the junior level tasks to save money, who is left to step up when the complex systems fail? If the AI system goes down or the internet is severed, do you still have cross-trained humans in your office who actually know how to do the math, write the code, or process the orders by hand? Are you building a resilient tiered workforce of skills, or are you just hoping your automated core system never encounters a severe disruption?
That's a great point.
Next time you hear a symphony or just drink your morning coffee, ask yourself, who is your backup tuba player?